This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the think spot in the metaverse, where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, the war in Ukraine. Is either side winning, and how can we tell? The war in Ukraine is about to enter its sixth month. The cost of Russia's invasion has been enormous. Millions of refugees, thousands of dead soldiers, thousands more dead civilians, and billions of dollars worth of physical damage. It's the most consequential military conflict of my generation, and seemingly the most difficult to predict. But let's try. This week, I want to know what's happening on the ground, and whether either side is close to victory or collapse. Step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out. Let's recall first how this began and how it progressed. Nina Kuryata is the Ukraine expert at Tortoise Media. She used to be the head of the BBC's Ukrainian service in Kyiv. Nina Kuryata, on February the 24th, and you were in Ukraine at the time, the Russians invaded. Can you remind listeners what were Russia's initial tactics?
I would describe it as shocking the whole country, because they started bombing and shelling all Ukraine from the far western regions to far eastern regions. It was not only about bombing the military infrastructure, but civilian infrastructure and residential buildings as well.
Was it your view at the time, is it still your view, that Russia's objective was to try and either to get the Ukrainian government to surrender very quickly or to topple the Ukrainian government?
I think their tactics was to take Kyiv first, because immediately after that massive shellings and bombings across Ukraine, Russian tanks appeared around Kyiv and they entered the city. And later we came to know that a lot of attackers were very close to the governmental buildings and to presidential administration, and that a few attacks have been stopped there.
So does that tell us that Russia was expecting a quick war?
Yes, I think so.
That didn't happen, clearly. What did the Russians then do? How did they move on?
When they understood that there will be no success there, they changed the tactics. They concentrated their forces at a few parts of the front line, and they started to take city by city in the eastern part of Ukraine. And then we all saw Mariupol. Then they took part of Zaporizhia region, these southern regions, and they are very important because they are close to the Azov Sea, and there are ports which are very important for the steel and grain exports.
So it was Russia's decision to move the focus of the war down to the south and to the east, along the Black Sea coast, the Sea of Azov, and the Donbass and Luhansk regions in the east. Is that now where the fighting is taking place?
Mostly, yes, but we are still cautious about Belarus. We have a northern border with Belarus, and there are a lot of Belarus troops over there, and we never know if they are going to attack us from the north again, because Kyiv is on the north, and Kyiv is still the strategic goal for Russians.
And how would you characterize the progress of the war in the south and the east?
They are slow, and Russians have a lot of military, a lot of ammunition, and this is like their advantage. And also, I have to say that they are not just fighting on the front line, they are terrorizing the whole nation of Ukraine, because they are hitting the residential building and civilian infrastructure in central Ukraine, in western Ukraine, wherever. So there is no safe place in Ukraine anymore, nowhere, because Russia is not fighting with us for our territories. Russia is fighting with us to destroy us as a nation, to delete us as a nation. And if we surrender, we will disappear as a nation anyway. So there is no point to give up waiting for the peace. There will be no peace if we give up.
Nina Kuryata with how we got here. But where, in terms of the war, is here? What's happening militarily? And can it be sustained? Joining me in the briefing room are Samantha Debenden, an associate fellow in the Russia and Eurasia programme at Chatham House, and Shashank Joshi, the defence editor at The Economist. Shashank Joshi, 5 months in, what kind of war is this now?
This is an attritional contest. It's a grinding slugfest that is dominated by artillery of various kinds. In many cases, if you looked at the defensive positions on either side, you would think you were looking at something out of Verdun or the Somme, big trench lines, defensive fortifications. And many infantry soldiers don't even see the soldiers they're fighting, which is incredibly demoralizing. They're hunkered down facing enormous artillery barrages that are chewing through huge numbers of shells every day. But for now, what this is really an attritional contest designed to wear down each side, not blow through their lines in a kind of 1940-style blitzkrieg.
Samantha, is that also your perception?
Yes, it really is. I mean, I've been analysing this war on a day-by-day basis for French television, actually, and we have spent literally hours talking about, you know, which bridge is going to go next. So it really is an inch-by-inch war in which both sides are moving forward, moving backwards, getting stuck in trenches, absolutely.
And David, what I just add to that is we heard from Mark Milley, the chairman of America's Joint Chiefs of Staff, a short while ago, and he said for the last 90 days, the Russian advances have amounted to roughly 6 to 10 miles. That's basically nothing. It's far short of the kind of breakthrough they would have anticipated and would have wanted.
Samantha, one of the stories that I thought we were hearing was one of slow but steady Russian advance. The picture you're painting is actually slightly different.
Well, not really. I mean, the Russians are advancing, but the Ukrainians are beginning to make counter-offensives, particularly in the south. There's a region called Kherson, which is occupied by the Russians. It's south of Ukraine. And here that the Ukrainians are beginning to fight back, and they're destroying Russian arms dumps as well. But the Russians are still advancing, and they have eaten away quite a bit of Ukrainian territory since the beginning of the war.
OK, Shashank, let's talk about what the West has done to help this phase of the Ukrainian war effort. What has the West physically done to help the Ukrainians, and how much of a difference has it been making?
This is, I would say, the biggest transfer of military weapons to one country in this space of time since the American Lend-Lease effort to Europe in the Second World War. We're seeing a huge influx of arms, and not just arms, but also intelligence. That's a much more discreet, covert form of assistance. But there's no doubt in my mind, the Americans, the Brits and others are giving Ukraine quite tactical intelligence that is helping Ukraine identify very high-value Russian sites, and that is ultimately helping them kill Russian generals.
Wow.
So that, I think, is undoubtedly happening. I think more recently, the most important bit of kit that is finding its way to Ukraine is what we call HIMARS, which is essentially a rocket launcher that fires these little missiles that are GPS-guided rounds. It's incredibly precise. It is much longer range than all of the artillery sent previously. And it is effectively making mincemeat out of Russian high-value sites like ammunition depots, command posts. That is now, in the last month or so, making a really substantial difference to the war, I think.
Okay, but Samantha, these things have to be produced. How much are we able, and this is the West generally, to supply, and are we able to keep on supplying?
I think this is the most crucial question. And to put this question into perspective, I'd just like to give some figures. We've talked about the HIMARS. I mean, the US has given 8, the Ukrainians say they need between 45 and 50 if they want to really make a difference. That is a lot. And the question is, how much can the US deliver without beginning to dig into its own stocks? So, of course, these figures are approximate because they are open source intelligence and the real intelligence is being kept secret. But the US, for instance, has given anti-tank systems called Javelins to Ukraine. They've given them 7,000. That is 30% of known US stockpiles. So what the US has already given Ukraine will take about 3 years to replenish. And all the countries are facing similar problems. Without going into a war economy and producing more, not only will we not be able to help Ukraine, but we might start feeling the shortfall as well.
Okay, so this is more precarious in many ways than it seems. Shashank, in addition to intelligence and artillery, what else has the West been doing to help Ukraine militarily?
They've been training the Ukrainians, and some of that is training on how to use the weapons they're getting. But I think the other important thing is much more basic. They're getting help with basic infantry training. I think the UK plans on training about 10,000 Ukrainians in 120 days is going to be absolutely vital to manning all the brigades that they will need, particularly in the south, where Samantha mentioned in Kherson province, I think they hope to make their biggest gains.
Does Western and military intelligence believe, as far as we know, that the Ukrainians are now able to begin an offensive given the training and given the munitions?
The Western officials I talk to distinguish between counterattacks, which are more tactical, smaller offensives, like the type we've seen in Kherson so far, and counteroffensives, which are big assaults along an entire front. And I'm afraid there is still skepticism that the Ukrainians have enough trained, equipped brigades, a formation of perhaps several thousand men with all the equipment you'd need to really push forwards. And David, if there's one lesson of this war, I think it's that defense is dominant. It's very hard to dislodge people from well-defended trenches, fortifications, positions. And that has worked to the Ukrainians' advantage for much of this campaign, but they're going to find it working to their detriment as they in turn go on the offensive. So I think they will struggle. And there's a debate underway as to whether they should begin perhaps in the autumn when more weapons will have come through and the Russians will be depleted, or whether they will really have to wait for much longer than that before they can build up the strength necessary for this.
Samantha, what's happening on the Russian side? Because they have been fighting for 5 months, a really big war, lobbing over thousands of missiles and tens of thousands of shells. How long can they keep doing this for? And what's the effect on their own military situation and their own military morale?
I think you really have to distinguish two things here, which on the one hand are the weapons that the Russians have, and on the other hand, the military morale. In terms of weapons, Russia is in full war economy mode right now. The president signed a decree a few weeks ago saying that all companies have to obey state orders. If they're asked to switch their production to war production, i.e. weapons production, they will. Russia has a vast arsenal of Soviet-era weaponry. The problem with this Soviet-era weaponry is that it's unreliable and very imprecise. And in terms of the more modern missiles that they have, they're now running out of computer chips that are needed to build these missiles, because a lot of this was imported from the West. So this is an effect of sanctions. But weapons isn't really Russia's problem. Russia's problem is going to be morale in the army. There is a serious morale problem. There have been soldiers refusing to fight and who are allowed to go home because they're not conscripts. There's also covert mobilization taking place. So another law was passed last week in which every single constituent region of Russia had to supply volunteer brigades to Ukraine of around 400 men. Men who are reservists are receiving letters saying, can you please come to your local recruitment office? We need to update your file. When they get there, they're offered a contract to go to Ukraine. Some of the time they accept because the money is good and they want to go and defend the motherland. There are other cases of people who don't know that they can refuse. So this is the problem that Russia is going to be facing as we go into the autumn, unless there's a general mobilization. But you cannot mobilize unless you say the country is at war. And this is not a war. This is a special military operation.
So you can mobilize your industry on the basis that you're on a war footing, but you won't call it a war. But that doesn't permit you to mobilize as many soldiers as you would like, because you can't call it a war. So can I summarize what you're both saying as being that we're now in a situation pretty much of stasis? Shashank?
I think there's a caveat, which is the Russians haven't given up on the rest of Donbass. They've, of course, taken most of Luhansk province. What they haven't done is taken most of Donetsk province. Together, the two make up what we know as Donbass. And they still hope, I think, to assault or at least somehow attack these two big cities, Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. Kramatorsk, a big industrial town. This is now just west of the defensive line the Ukrainians are holding. So there, I think the Russians still have some offensive aspirations. But for all the reasons that Samantha has outlined, I wouldn't anticipate any major territorial gains. I think they're really a spent force. I think they're not going to have the manpower or the weaponry or the will to fight they would need to really make their way through the grinding urban warfare of those places. And so, yes, I think we are by and large entering into a period of prolonged stalemate. The only thing that would risk breaking it is if these HIMARS attacks on Russian logistics and depots and command posts are so devastating and relentless. And by the way, there are more HIMARS launches on the way from America, that the Russian army seizes up and is stretched too thin, or that the Ukrainian counteroffensive comes earlier than we expect and proves more effective than we think. But I think that would be optimistic. I think we are probably in for something of a less fluid stalemate for the weeks and months to come.
And Samantha, do you broadly agree with that?
I broadly agree with that. I think we mustn't underestimate the shelling of cities we're going to continue seeing. We've seen a marked increase in the past few weeks of just shelling of civilian targets in cities, in shopping malls and city centres in the south, in the east, even cities right in the centre of Ukraine. And I think the Russian tactics here to try and demoralise the population, and it's having the complete opposite effect. But sadly, I think that as the military situation on the ground grinds to stalemate, out of frustration, the Russians will just continue pounding Ukrainian cities and sadly probably moving further and further west as well.
Samantha Dibenden and Shashank Joshi. What I want to know now is how the war is being seen outside Ukraine. In Russia, where sanctions imposed by countries in the West should be having some effect, and in those countries that are providing the most material support to Ukraine, will that support be sustained? Samantha Dibenden is still with me, and we're joined now in the briefing room by Sir Lawrence Freedman, Emeritus Professor of War Studies at King's College London. Lawrence Freedman, what do you understand to be President Putin's overall strategy, and is it changing?
Putin's problem is that there are limits now on what he can achieve militarily. There are now assessments coming out of Washington. The Russians can keep going maybe for a month and a half, before their campaign really gets into serious difficulties in being able to sustain any sort of assault on Ukrainian positions. Meanwhile, they're concerned that the Western weaponry coming into Ukraine's service is really making it even harder for them to keep going and makes possible Ukrainian counterattacks. So they're quite worried, I think, about the developing military situation on the ground, which is why they're talking in even more ambitious terms about what their objectives are. I think that's normally a sign that they're worried. So I think their main hope is that building pressure on Western European governments because of the cost of living, because of inflation, because of gas shortages, all of these things is going to lead them to seek an early end of the war. And that means putting pressure on Zelensky and holding back on advanced weaponry rather than providing more of it.
Samantha, do you broadly agree with that, that actually Putin now regards the potential weak link in the Ukrainian position, the pressure possibly in the West for there to be some kind of solution which allows Russia to claim a victory?
I do agree with that. I think that he's aware of the fact that particularly in Western Europe, we're facing a very cold winter, that there are inflationary pressures in every single West European country. He's probably counting on lots of street riots in my country where I'm living right now, which is France, where people tend to sort of, you know, go out on the street at the drop of a hat. Yes, he's expecting the West to give in once we really begin to feel the pain. And I think this winter is going to be crucial for Ukraine. It seems to be the UK position that might not change even with a new prime minister. The big unknown here are Western Europe, the EU, and in particular France and Germany, how long they will resist pressures from their population to put pressure in turn on Zelensky to make concessions.
Lawrence Freeman, what do you think?
The options are not that easy. Even if the French and the Germans came to the conclusion, which I don't think they will, that they have to ditch Zelensky. Actually, turning that into policy is quite difficult because they'd face an enormous amount of opposition from the rest of NATO or the EU in doing so. You have to put in the strength of the feeling in Central and Eastern Europe about standing up to Russia, particularly Poland and the Baltic states. There are issues about how far they're prepared to go with the weaponry. But the logic of the situation is that you strengthen the military support because actually the only way you're going to get a breakthrough now is if the Russian military really start to feel the pain and are pushed onto the back foot.
What about Washington? We know that there were accusations that Donald Trump was, to say the very least, cold about the issue about whether Americans should make sacrifices in order to help people abroad. And obviously, there's still a possibility both of a Republican victories in the midterms in autumn and of a Republican win in the next presidential election in 2024. How worried are people about that?
I certainly think that in Eastern Central Europe, there's a very great fear of what will happen in the US in 2024, not only insofar as support for the war in Ukraine is concerned, but insofar as NATO's Article 5. So to remind listeners, NATO's Article 5 is the article under which an attack on one is an attack on all. And there's this fear in the Baltics, in Poland, in Czech Republic, that if Donald Trump or a non-interventionist Republican is elected in the US, that NATO's Article 5 would not work, and that would be the day that Putin decides to start dipping his toes into some of the Baltics or some of Poland.
Can I just sort of respond to a couple of things that Samantha said? First, Republicans so far, by substantial majorities in Congress, have supported the support for Ukraine. The don't support Ukraine, support Putin wing of the party is quite small. So I don't think it's an issue for the midterm elections. Who knows where we're going to be if this thing is still going on for the 2024 elections. So I'm less worried about the Americans. As I said before, I think a lot depends on the ability of the Ukrainians to shift the military balance over the next couple of months.
Lawrence Freeman, what is the realistic Western assessment of the impact of Western sanctions on Russia?
I think the idea that sanctions would bring Russia to its knees early has clearly not been the case. And I'm not sure how many people really believed it. The funds flowing into Russia because of the high price of oil and gas has meant that financially Russia is not so much in a bad state. But it is hitting in terms of their manufacturing capacity, in unemployment. So it's starting to hit in terms of standard of living. But I think most importantly, in terms of the course of the war in defence production, I think that's where there's a big hit.
Samantha, you have contacts in Russia who've been experiencing the consequences of the sanctions directly. What have they told you?
Well, they said things like, you know, we now can't get any good quality medicines. Women can't get decent sanitary towels, you know, beauty products. All those things are beginning to be felt. But really what's revealing are the official statistics year on year for automobile production are down 97%. Buses down 77%, you know, trucks 58%, electric engines 50%, washing machines 59%. Civil aviation is also suffering. So they're putting some of the fleet on standby, cannibalizing airplanes so that they can get spare parts to keep some of the airplanes in the air, because the sanctions are definitely beginning to bite.
And Are they having a political effect? In other words, do they turn Russians against Putin or not?
From what I've heard, not yet. But as time goes by, as the dead begins to come home, the soldiers who are dying in Ukraine, when you start to add on, shortages are going to appear. I think that that is where there's a chance that you might start to have a shift in Russia. The central bank governor said something really interesting. She said, the issue in Russia today isn't money. I mean, the ruble is getting stronger. There is cash in the economy. There's nothing to buy. From an economic point of view, our problem is going to be deficit, which is an old Soviet word, which really meant shortages.
Samantha, one of the aspects of Russian strategy appears to be the desire to occupy other parts of Ukraine, notably in the east. What's actually been happening in the areas that Russia has taken over since the end of February?
We've seen a very strong attempts at Russification of these areas. So it's starting with introducing the ruble, introducing the Russian mobile network. And we have what's called the passportization of these areas. So there have been a number of decrees issued by Putin allowing for the inhabitants of the Donetsk and Luhansk areas to obtain a rapid, a fast-stream process to get Russian passports. This has happened in Kherson and Zaporizhia. There were also plans for referendum to take place in Kherson, which is the occupied part in the south of Ukraine, for a referendum to take place on incorporating it into the Russian Federation. I've also heard talks of the referenda being taken place in the other occupied areas in the Donbass and in the Zaporizhia. Militarily, what this would mean is that if these referenda take place and the result is more or less a foregone conclusion that they will be, you know, fraudulent referendums and these areas will be incorporated into Russia. Any Ukrainian counteroffensive on these territories would then be considered to be an offensive on Russian territory.
Lawrence, do you get an impression of what it is, since the question always arises, that Putin would settle for in order to say things can stop now?
It's impossible to say because you get so many different accounts of what Russia cares about and what Russia wants at the moment. And this goes back to how Samantha described what's going on in the occupied areas. They're talking about the annexation, Russification of large chunks of Ukraine. I think this is bluster. And I think we have to be clear that there's a lot of bluster going on. But what's going on in the occupied territories is real. But so long as they're under military pressure, they can't, for example, have a referendum in Kherson. So I think the problem for Putin is that even the lesser objectives he set, as opposed to denazification and demilitarization of the whole country, which is how he started, which was essentially changing the government, have shifted to the Donbass. He's got most of Luhansk, but he hasn't got more than half of Donetsk and very little chance of getting it over the next few months. So then you get back to the sort of things that actually the peace talks were about early on, Ukrainian neutrality, different sort of collective security arrangements. And when that happens, you can have a possibility of a peace deal, but it's going to involve a Russian withdrawal.
I'm going to put this to you both now. Would you rather be a Russian or a Ukrainian general right now, Samantha?
If I were a Russian general and I was seeing what was happening in the army, what was happening to my men, and thinking about what's happening in Moscow, I might be tempted to think, well, me and my brother generals, we are the only people who could actually make a real difference here. How tempting would it be to really mount a coup and end up being a hero for the rest of history who would save the world?
With one bound, we were free. Lawrence Freeman, what would you say?
I think operationally, I'd be more optimistic, but with many qualifications as a Ukrainian general than a Russian general. There isn't a tradition in Russia of military coups. They have a very strong tradition of subordination to political leadership. However, I do think their assessments are critical. They're the ones who have to say, actually, we can't go on like this. We're not going to have much of an army left. They are going to be the ones that have to tell the home truth to Putin that actually they're losing and there's a risk they're going to get severely embarrassed. I think that's the role of the Russian military in bringing this war to an end.
So Lawrence Freeman there with Samantha Dibenden. And I guess one's conclusion to that is, if there are any Russian generals listening, You know what your options are. My thanks to Nina Curiata, Samantha Debendon, Shashank Joshi and Sir Lawrence Freeman. The Briefing Room will be back next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Ronovich. The producers were Simon Watts, Tim Mansell and Kirstine Knight. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. The editor is Richard Varden. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Briefing Room, there are many others to listen to on BBC Sounds. You can hear how the war in Ukraine has changed politics in Germany, for example, or how worried we should be about the new variants of the COVID virus.
J. Edgar Hoover created and ran the FBI for almost 50 years.
Nobody should have that powerful position for that length of time.
His job was to enforce the law, but he did not always follow it.
Hoover was basically creating a secret police.
Find out what his FBI looked like.
This is like Stasi.
And hear firsthand from the group who had an astonishing plan to expose him.
We became convinced that the FBI was illegal.
From BBC Radio 4. The People versus J. Edgar Hoover with me, Emily Maitlis. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.